Morning. I feel a lot of what I'm going to try and say has already been said, and probably said a lot better, but never mind, we'll go for it anyway. My topic's entitled Thinking Like Paul, and it's from this passage in Philippians. If we could just have the, are we able to put the passage up? Hey, Martin, that would be great at some point. Paul, of course, was a huge intellect, and it was his work that was responsible for the spread of Christianity in the early days through his travels and preaching, and also by what he wrote, as in the letters to the various churches. This letter to the Philippians was written when he was in prison, and I can imagine prison even now is not very nice, but I believe in those days it must have been fairly uncomfortable, to say the least, and that Paul must have suffered a great deal in those experiences and other things that he went through in his life. But despite all that, as we heard from Dick last week, it is the case that this whole letter is written with a sort of sense of joy. And the words in today's passage are hugely positive and optimistic. So just apologies in advance if I make them sound depressing, because that's what I have a tendency to do about anything. Paul, of course, is known for his in-depth doctrinal writing, some of which are quite hard to get our minds round. Passages like, or the book of Romans or Galatians, he goes into great detailed theological arguments. Today, Philippians isn't quite like that, and today's passage isn't really like that. It's more about how Paul's mind deals with everyday things, and how he draws the deep eternal truths of the gospel which he has preached into his day-by-day, hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute thought life. He can sometimes be talking about something fairly mundane, and then in the next sentence or phrase he's linking this to some profound spiritual truth. And I think this is a sort of pattern for Paul of linking the deeply spiritual things to everyday life. And I'm going to sort of refer to that sort of thing a few times. I'm going to leave the passage on the screen, and you can just refer to it. Much of today's passage is fairly straightforward stuff, and all you really need to do is read it. So please do that just if you want. I'm going to focus on the sort of most famous verses of the passage, but not just because of the most famous, but because I think they probably most closely align to our topic of thinking. So it slightly annoys me, I'm afraid. I'm not able to deal with the comprehensively with the whole passage that I've been given, but I just wasn't able to. So I'm going to start first of all with verse 4. I don't know, is that on the screen at the moment? The verse is a very famous verse: "Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice." Some of us know this as a wee chorus from the 70s, which you sort of sing as a round. I won't get you to sing it like you sang Count Your Blessings, but it's one of the stupid wee tunes that's sort of ingrained in my memory from times past. So, "Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice." You could just say it over and over again. I'm going to try and relate it to my life. In the morning, I get up. I have my pre-work nervous ablutions. I shave, I get dressed, I take the dog out, I turn on Radio Scotland and listen to some anti-SNP propaganda. I empty the dishwasher, I make the packed lunches, I clean my teeth, I have a fat panic because I can't find my phone. I say my goodbye to my wife and family, who don't respond because they're still half asleep, and then I walk to the office. And throughout this, I think, rejoice. That's what it says I should be doing. And sometimes there are moments when I do, especially on a lovely day when Kelvingrove Park is looking good. But do I do it always? Probably not. I was discussing this with my mother, who is here today. She had been complaining to me about something or other, that something like she gets no visitors or something like that, which is completely untrue. But I said, you can't say that. You must rejoice in the Lord always. She then said, yes, but you can't always take what you read in the Bible literally. I said, there you go. I thought you loved your Bible, and there you are watering it down. Paul says, rejoice in the Lord always. Of course, she probably is right. You can't constantly be in that sort of frame of mind. How you feel varies with what's going on in your life. Indeed, you probably wouldn't want it otherwise. Life would actually be quite boring if you were constantly experiencing the same emotion all the time. So somehow I think what's being said here is a bit deeper than the sort of just having a smiley face all the time. Notice that it's not just rejoice, it's rejoice in the Lord. May you always be joyful, or another translation, you always be joyful in union with the Lord. I think we have a tendency sometimes to live a kind of fragmented lives, especially if we have a religious background. We can sometimes split our lives into the God bits and the non-God bits. This has been something I've noticed in my life, even at a young age. I started supporting Celtic when I was 7, and remember being in tears when they were beaten in the European Cup final of 1970. For the rest of my childhood, I had a not unusual passion that a boy would have for football. I was more interested in studying the wee red book than the Bible, and my level of happiness rose and fell with the fortunes of Celtic each Saturday. I would then go to church and sit in a mournful communion service and relive in my head the moments from last night's sports scene. Later, when I started to play football, at the service I used to relive the great moments of my play the day before, scoring goals or making a great tackle, and I would go over these in my head. I hadn't rejected God, and I believed what I was being told at church, and to an extent my faith grew, but all the while there was a nagging feeling that actually the things which had nothing to do with church or God were the bits of my life where I found my most happiness or joy. What I would say to myself now is that there's nothing unspiritual about football or sport, but I should recognise the good and the true in it. The harder thing now, I suppose, is recognising God's at times, other times maybe at our work or when family life is stressful or whenever. But this verse is just giving a sort of joyful perspective over it all. Rejoice in the Lord, I think, means letting God be God within us, or another expression, the ground of our being. Let that God pervade all parts of our thinking and existence. And I don't think this is always was easy. It's probably important that we to help this to happen by taking time each day to think through the events of the day and start understanding how God already works in us, and what are the things that maybe block that happening. I know that there are good spiritual exercises that help with this sort of thing. The important thing is to try and maybe give your mind and your body a break from normal business. And that's also the sort of Sabbath principle as well, taking time off to relax from the day-to-day business of life is something which allows you to enjoy the good things and be thankful for what we've been given. So I'd like to move on to verse 6 now, which is, do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. So this is about worry. They use the word anxious here, but I think the Good News translation says, don't worry about anything. In all your prayers, ask God for what you need. Now, I'm a terrible worrier, so there are obviously personality aspects to worry. Some people seem to worry more than others. I was just hearing how Jim Reedy never worries about his work. at coffee time there. I don't know if that's true, Jim. So some of us can be more prone to it than others. I think we've also got to distinguish raw fear from worry. If you're being chased by a wild animal, then fear is a necessary response to make us do something about our situation. Worry is probably something less acute than fear, more like a sort of nagging toothache that comes back at you. And Paul says here that we shouldn't do it. Worry can hit you when you're waking up in the middle of the night. It can be due to your life situation. All sorts of bad things that I've already touched on were discussed last week. Illness, fear of illness, your financial situation, problems with members of your family. But you can also have more sort of immediate annoying worries, like how are you going to deal with an awkward colleague at work, or how are you going to get your new organised for your new kitchen to be installed. And Paul's instruction is to pray, not just to ask God for what you need, and not just that, but to ask God for what you need and do it with a thankful heart. And remember, Paul was in prison when he wrote this. I wonder, do you think he asked God to release him from prison? Maybe he did, but he hasn't said that here. We should ask God for what we need. In doing that, it somehow gives us peace of mind, even though the actual source of the worry is maybe not taken away. You still have to sit the exam or go to the doctor's appointment or deal with those debts. But the very act of praying and naming those worries, I think, is helpful. And in doing so, you get a sense of peace as you sort of leave your worries with God. Now, as I've said, I'm a terrible worrier, and so I'm probably the worst person to testify to the reality of this verse. I think the only advice I can give myself and everyone else is just to go with it, and always try and have this thankful heart, as Ev was sort of saying as well. Look for things in my situation that I can be thankful for, and that helps to put your worries in perspective. So we could leave this verse as it is, and if you want to, please do that. But what I'm going to say next is perhaps what you might say a bit theologically speculative, but I'm going to go with it anyway, and you can ignore it if you want. Looking at the verse again, what Paul says is we get God's peace, a peace which passes all understanding. I wonder if this is an example of how Paul jumps from the everyday things like your everyday worries to something more profound. It's like the outcome is almost more than you're asking for. You ask God for a wee worry to go away and you get a peace that passes all understanding. And it's a sort of a beautiful expression. This leads me to think that maybe Paul is also talking about more profound worries. We hear a lot about anxiety today, and as I understand it, anxiety is something that where the cause is not totally clear to the person who's suffering it. You might worry about something specific, but you can just be anxious. Now, this is where we can maybe stray onto the realm of mental health, and I admit I don't want really to do that, and I've no expertise in that. So, but I do wonder if on a spiritual level we can suffer from a kind of anxiety. This can maybe be caused by a lack of meaning in life, what's it all about sort of stuff. Everything we do is ultimately useless. That's what the book in the Bible, the book of Ecclesiastes, is about. And perhaps more fundamentally, I think there is in people perhaps a deep-seated feeling that we don't quite measure up to what we ourselves want ourselves to be. There's a kind of disconnect between our true selves and the person we portray to others, and possibly to ourselves too. We've already talked a bit about social media, and that was the example I was going to use here, where people like to show off how many friends they have, how attractive and humorous they are, and how involved they are in doing all sorts of interesting things and worthy things. but the reality of their lives isn't maybe like that. And I just use that as an example of how we can maybe try and create this image of ourselves, which is how we want to be and for others to see us, but it doesn't match up to the reality of what we're actually like. We realise that we're not the wonderful person we would like to be. A word which some modern theologians have used to describe this is shame. This kind of shame is maybe what causes the deep-seated spiritual anxieties. Of course, we have the usual ways of dealing with these things, our society does. We might drink alcohol, or we might engage in some sort of retail therapy. I think advertisers feed off this nowadays. They sort of feed off this idea that to sell us this potential image of ourselves that is something better than what we are, and to sell us the myth that if we buy their product, somehow it turns us into the people we really want to be. Just do it, says Nike, implying that if you buy their running shoes, you will do it. In fact, if you buy their running shoes, you're more likely to injure yourself than you are if you wear an old pair of gutties when you're running. And that's true, that's scientific. We as thinking Christians are supposed to be immune to all this advertising stuff. But hands up, who owns some Nike shoes? Yeah, quite a few, yeah. So you've all been taken in. So that's this is where I'm jumping from the trivial to the profound, just like that, you know. So these sorts of things, like buying new shoes or one of the other common ones, I think nowadays, I have to say, is going on holiday. We're always looking for the next holiday to get us out of the situation we're in. And holidays, as we know, as I've already said, are good, but sometimes I think maybe there's a sense in which we use them to get out of, not to face up to the actual joys of our life that we have in the here and now. This sort of anxiety I'm talking about, other people, some people call it existential anxiety or existential angst. I love that expression. Of course, in the biblical language that causes this disconnection is called sin, but for some 20th century Western people, the word sin perhaps has less meaning than previous generations. While Paul doesn't mention it here, the passage in Romans 7 where he talks at length about his inner conflicts is his account of how this sense of shame or sin affected him. And if you want, you try reading that passage sort of dispassionately. He really seems a bit of a screwed up personality in that passage in Romans 7. But of course, he's one of the greatest Christian thinkers of all time, and his answer to that is the same as to that inner conflict is the same one as applies to us. The verse says, "The peace that passes all understanding will guard our hearts," or I've got it in the Good News, "keep your hearts and minds safe in union with Christ Jesus." So I wonder if we do have the echoes of the cross here. Jesus draws us back together and keeps us together as human beings. Jesus was the one man who lived life where there was no disconnect between how life should be lived and how he did live. There was no gap between what he presented to the world and his true self, and yet somehow his death, he took on that disconnectedness and shame that is the lot of human beings. Jesus, the one person who did life the way it's supposed to be, and somehow paradoxically, by submitting to the ultimate anxiety, in some way enables us to become at one with ourselves and with God. Our hearts and minds are kept safe through Jesus as we go through this process of atonement. Now, we as evangelical Christians, as we're called in this church, tend to emphasise the importance of seeing things at an individual level I've just talked about our individual worry, which can be related to ourselves or the situations we find ourselves in. But as individuals, we live together as communities, families, workplaces, cities, churches, nations, etc. I think at all these levels, there can be anxieties, all of which can then feed down to us as individuals. We can choose to ignore the anxieties, or we can take it on as part of our own responsibilities, as Paul did at the church level with in the early part of the chapter in the passage where he dealt with the Euodia and Syntyche by trying to help them out, sort out their disagreements. I don't know if we've got that on the screen at the moment. Dick talked about that particular situation last week. So Paul very much saw that the disharmony within the church could affect everyone in the church. And I think some of that dissatisfaction and unhappiness that we as a country suffer from, and Dick mentioned that last week as well, is due to a sort of national form of this same sense of disconnectedness. Possibly this comes about from the huge inequalities in wealth and opportunities in this country. This makes our society disconnected, and as members of that society, we share in it. There was a very interesting book that came out a few years ago called The Spirit Level, which found that the happiest countries were those where the gap between the rich and the poor was at its smallest. The rich in these countries were happier than the equivalent rich people in countries where the gap was greater. Even the rich were happier. Yeah. I have to mention, because it was in the news, that there was this thing about this company called Mossack Fonseca. I'm sure you all, did everyone hear about it in the news? And it sort of showed us how the rich, not only do the rich not only are they much richer, but they managed to, or forgive me for over simplifying this, but there's a tendency for them to squirrel away their riches in offshore accounts so that they don't even pay the taxes. So that sort of thing again adds to the kind of disconnectedness with our society, and it makes people like you and me absolutely livid, doesn't it? We who pay our taxes. In my view, we can't fully separate out our society level anxieties from our own personal ones. While we live with such vast wealth inequalities, while we live with the vast spending and weapons of war, while we live with the known destruction of the world's ecosystems, then can we say that the work of Jesus reconciling all things on earth and heaven, spoken of by Paul in Colossians 1:20, can we say that work is done? I believe we need to include all this stuff in our prayers as well as our personal worries. And we did that this morning in the first service. However we do this, whether it's in our own prayers or through meditation studies or in groups or in church services. So let's move on to verse 8 now, which is the last bit I want to talk about, which is the verse that Ev's already focused on. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. This is, again, one of the great verses of the Bible. And again, it's there to be read rather than necessarily to be analysed too much. Can we go through our own thought life, or the things that we feed our thought life, the stuff we consume in the media, the types of conversations we have, and ensure that they meet all these criteria? So going back to my example of, as a boy, I used to dwell in the beautiful footballing skills of Kenny Dalglish. That's probably okay, isn't it? Lovely, admirable, excellent, praiseworthy. My wife warned me not to give you my views on what I think is bad on TV. So I won't mention Top Gear or Jeremy Clarkson. And of course, I know there's going to be a new Top Gear, but I'm sure it'll be equally bad. There is an awful lot of rubbish on TV, particularly programmes like Top Gear. But one person's rubbish is another person's relaxation. So it's really up to you to apply the criteria of Paul to your own lives. It's not always totally simple. Sometimes there are things that on the face of it are not lovely, but they still may be true. And a lot of films are like that. I can remember watching the start of the film Saving Private Ryan, which shows the horrors of the D-Day landings. That was an attempt at an honest and true portrayal of that piece of history. It certainly wasn't lovely. But there's also no doubt something that dark within a lot of people that enjoys watching the violence. Many people will remember the campaigns of Mary Whitehouse in the 1970s, if you're of a certain generation. She used to campaign against portrayal of sex and violence in the TV, and she became a figure of some ridicule at the time. However, I think she did raise awareness, and perhaps in those days, people had more of a sense that there had to be judgment of what was maybe right to watch and what wasn't. Nowadays, because there's just so much stuff around, whether it's in our Netflix or iPlayer, internet, social media, there is, I think, a sense of almost resignation that we're just passive recipients of all this stuff. I think if we're obeying these verses, we should be exercising judgment on what we spend our time thinking about. There's also things related to the quantity of what we consume. And again, the Facebook thing I'm going to mention, if we're spending all our time on things like Facebook or Twitter, it's probably a bad thing. Personally, I'm more of a Twitter man myself. As you know, there's a lot of nasty stuff written by some people on Twitter. But at the same time, there's a lot of stuff that you find out about that you wouldn't find out about in normal media. There's also a lot of opinion about things that you would not get on the TV and newspapers. So that maybe allows you to see some truth that you wouldn't otherwise. And as we've heard, Facebook can be good too when you're using it to just keep up with friends or keep friendships going that you wouldn't otherwise, or other stuff like that. So we can use this verse as a kind of set of tests as to what we think about. But let's be a bit more positive to finish. It's also a positive instruction. Remember, the whole book of Philippians is about joy, so we should actively seek out these things that Paul talks about. If we hear about a lovely book, maybe it's time to read it. If one of our friends tells us about a good film they saw, then make a point of going to see it. It's all good as far as Paul is concerned. If we fill our minds with what is good, then, as Dick said last week, it can maybe help us deal with the worries and the anxieties too. So that's really it. I just want to draw your attention to the bits in the passage that I've missed. I missed completely chapter 3, verse 28, so I'm sorry about that. But verse 5 of chapter 4, it says, "Show a gentle attitude to everyone." I've talked a lot about how we think about ourselves, but Paul reminds us that it's our attitude to others that really is important. And then verse 9, "Put into practice what you've learned." It's not all about thinking, it's about doing too. Thank you.